Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Al Franken is resigning, which we boldly predicted would happen. But what does it mean for partisan politics?
The Supreme Court took up the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. Sam Baker from Axios tells us about the oral arguments.
And Donald Trump declared that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Why the hell did he do that?
I'm Elise Foley.
And I'm Arthur Delaney.
And this is So That Happened, the HuffPost politics podcast about things that happened in politics.
Serving in the United States Senate has been the great honor of my life. I know in my heart that nothing I have done as a senator has brought this honor on this institution. Nevertheless, today I am announcing that in the coming weeks, I will be resigning as a member of the United States Senate.
Hi, I'm Elise Foley, and I'm here with Arthur Delaney.
Hi.
And Marina Fang.
Hello.
And we are going to talk about the big news that Al Franken, the Democratic senator from Minnesota, has announced that he's going to resign. He's going to step down in the coming weeks, he said. And he went on the Senate floor, and it was kind of an interesting speech. He sort of said that he hasn't done the things that he's been accused of in terms of groping women. That's been the main thing. There's been a bunch of stories of him trying to grab people that didn't want to be grabbed or kiss people didn't want to be kissed. He said he didn't do any of that and remembers these situations differently, but that it's, you know, important at this time to listen to women, and he is going to get out of there. So it was interesting. It was interesting timing.
He kind of buried the lead a bit in his speech. He didn't really get
that's
to
what politicians
the, I mean,
do.
True, but he did sort of, it was interesting how he did that. But anyway, yes. Okay, that's fair.
What caused it to happen was this political story with, I think, the seventh person to say that they'd had an unwanted...
Eighth, actually.
There's oh, okay. been eight yeah. now. Yeah, well, so after seven, I believe, it's so hard to keep track of all these numbers, but after seven, I think, was when a bunch of Democratic senators, who are women Democratic senators, came out and said, we think that he should resign.
Right. And that was also because this particular allegation, this woman... who used to be a Democratic aide, told Politico that he attempted to justify his behavior by saying, quote, I'm an entertainer. And
it's,
you know,
my right as an entertainer.
Right. It's my right as an entertainer. And obviously there's
the
some
word right in there.
Yeah. And also it kind of mirrors some other very familiar comments we've heard from a certain person
when
in
you're
the
a
Oval
star,
Office.
They let you do it.
Yeah.
One of the other things that was interesting in Franken's speech is that he brought up that it was ironic, which is true, that he's going to be leaving at the same time that Alabama is voting next week and potentially sending somebody who has been accused of various creepy behavior toward teen girls to the Senate. And also there is somebody in the White House who has been accused by multiple women of sexual harassment and assault. So here's that clip.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party. But this decision is not about me.
So Democrats are obtaining moral high ground through Franken doing this, through John Conyers resigning. The irony, as Franken put it, it's the difference between what the how the two parties are handling these accusations is incredibly stark right now. And for a while, Moore and Trump defenders had been saying, well, you've got Frank and you've got Conyers, so nothing really matters. We don't have to throw out our sex assaulters. And that dynamic is now gone.
Which is kind of I don't know, but I would guess is kind of the point of forcing them out is so that they can keep that moral high ground. And so they're willing to, you know, we'll kick out our guys if that means that we can continue to hammer on Roy Moore and Donald Trump.
And draw this line showing like, hey, look at us. We're not tolerating this, at least in our party.
Well, yeah, it happens also to be the right thing. If you say this is intolerable behavior, you don't tolerate. And then those people got
to
go.
It's good to not be hypocritical.
Yeah. But it's weird to see it. You know, Republicans recognize this, and Republican strategists sort of struggle with it. And on Twitter and on the internet, you'll see people say things like, well, Democrats are coordinating their efforts to strategically acquire the moral high ground for electoral purposes. And it's grotesque in a way, but true.
Yeah. I mean, I think the question, right, is if it's like, so what? Like, if the end result is something good, which is, you know, them sticking to what they say, which is that people shouldn't be in these offices if they've been accused of these things, even if they are doing that for political reasons, the end result is good, right? It's good to not be hypocrites. Politicians do all sorts of things for political reasons. That's why they do everything.
Right.
That's cynical. I shouldn't say that.
Get rid of Roy Moore if you don't like it.
Yeah.
He's awful.
If you're mad that Democrats are taking the moral high ground, like, you can join them up there.
Yeah,
if that's where you think the high ground is,
go there.
Go up.
Say what's right and wrong, and there you are, up there on the moral high ground. Republicans, while this has been happening, have gone in the opposite direction, whereas you know, they initially said Roy Moore is unacceptable. They not only changed their rhetoric, they started throwing money at him to help him win the election.
Yeah, the RNC is now back in the race after saying we're going to pull out our money. Now they've apparently decided it's okay. I think also because Trump has now officially endorsed Roy Moore, and I think that gave the RNC some cover to get back in there, which is, I mean, it's not surprising that Trump endorsed Roy Moore, but I do worry, and a lot of people have written about this, I do worry that it gives Republicans basically, like, maybe this is it, you know, this is
how we win now.
Right. We're at this point of no return.
Nothing matters.
Yeah, nothing matters.
Yeah, well, it is interesting, though, because although they have kind of, obviously the president has endorsed him and the RNC has given money, they haven't been super full-throated about it. They were saying, like, oh, the check was only $50,000 or something, which, you know, maybe isn't that much money in the scheme of these types of campaigns. And even McConnell and Paul Ryan have still said that they think that Moore is bad. McConnell said, okay, well, you know, clearly he's not going to resign and it's up to the people of Alabama to decide.
Right.
But then later, when people kind of confronted him, like, oh, are you going back on what you said before? He said, well, he still, you know, I'm just acknowledging the reality that that's the situation we have. Once he gets to the Senate, we'll look into him. Paul Ryan said that he still thinks that Moore should step down. So clearly some of them do think that it would be a bad idea. And that it is a bad idea to just decide that, no, we're just going to fully embrace this creepy dude.
I wonder if people will get used to it and it will stop becoming an issue. It seems like that's kind of what the you know, general Republican strategy is, that, okay, well, hopefully we can just win and have our senator. But
or just that if somebody denies it, then it's fine.
But I feel like people aren't going to let this go. I mean, Roy Moore's case is super extraordinary. Maybe it is the case that Donald Trump's transgressions have not been as much in the news as they were last summer, but I can't imagine reporters in the U.S. Senate, where you're constantly interacting with senators, just dropping it. It seems like it's going to continue to be a problem. Or am I being overly optimistic?
I don't know. I still think this is all political expediency. I mean, they've realized, okay, like, we can't... Earlier there had been these rumblings of like, oh, maybe we'll get a write-in candidate or...
Well, they did that. They did get a write-in candidate. I mean, that
I mean, yeah, you could still do that. Yeah. But ultimately, it seems like they've accepted, well, he might win and we want this to be a Republican seat and we're just going to just deal with it.
So you're saying that it does appear to be that they think people will kind of forget about it and move on.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm just very cynical that this will make a difference.
There have been a couple of cases where a Republican senator had engaged in, you know, apparently unacceptable behavior, like Senator David Vinner from Louisiana was on the D.C. Madams list.
Oh, yeah.
And there was Scott Desjarlais. It came out that before he was a congressman, also from Louisiana, I think that he had pressured a mistress to have an abortion. He's there. Vinner served out his term. Desjarlais is still around. No one really talks about that anymore.
Murphy from Pennsylvania, similar case where he pressured his mistress to have an abortion, but then he resigned.
He did resign.
So, a lot of it is voluntary, right? Like, or not really voluntary. I mean, you face pressure from your colleagues, but it's like ultimately the decision is yours. And so in these cases where there are elections, it's, you know, if the voters don't care enough or don't see it as the ultimate issue, then they'll still vote the person in, right? Like, that seems to be what's happening.
Yeah, they say, okay, well, the voters decided and the voters said it's okay, so I guess it's fine.
So if they found a person who individually has no shame whatsoever, that person can just continue.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with Moore, though, is that there will be other things that Republican leaders will probably, if he becomes a senator, not like him over as well. They're not, you know, they weren't fans of him before.
Oh, yeah,
he's
had an incredibly wacky career that has been overshadowed by his
and possibly molestation. Now, if he becomes a senator, all of the allegations will be overshadowed yet again by some sort of crazy behavior in the Senate. So I think we should revisit our bold predictions. At the end of last week's show, we made some bold predictions about what we thought was going to happen.
That's right. We made predictions about Franken and Conyers. What did we say? Do we have any bold predictions?
Bold predictions.
Will Franken step down? They're starting to pile up.
They're really starting to pile up with him. I think that he'll resign.
Yes, that's bold.
I think Conyers will resign.
Those are bold predictions.
Those are my bold predictions.
I second.
They're probably wrong.
I second those bold predictions.
I don't know. I was about to say that by the time listeners hear this, there will probably be more alleged sexual predators revealed. That's not a bold prediction at all.
That's not bold.
That's probably going to happen.
That wasn't bold at all, Marina.
Bold at all.
Oh. Well, Marina, your prediction wasn't bold, but it was true. I mean, there were a few people whose transgressions came to light over the last week.
No doubt by the time listeners hear this podcast as well, there will have been more.
Yeah, I mean, I can keep making that prediction. It's not bold. Also, I would like to point out that we have had, this is our like recurring sexual misconduct segment on this podcast.
Yeah, it's the so that creepy behavior happened.
Yeah.
Elise Foley, your bold prediction was so right.
I know. I wish that I hadn't said at the end, I'm probably wrong, but
that's okay.
That was just a, you know, sadness, probably.
Yeah, I don't think people even hear that. All they heard was the boldness. Wow, you nailed that.
It's my first time being bold correct.
I just seconded it.
Feel good about it.
Yeah, that was awesome. Well, we're winners.
Yep, we're winners. All right, well, thank you guys, and I'm sure we'll be able to all discuss this again.
Yep. Our recurring segment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, it's me, Arthur Delaney, and I have a special request. If you like So That Happened, please consider giving us a shout out on iTunes. Give us 4 or 5 stars. Please don't give us fewer than 4, though. Think of us as like an Uber, but for political commentary. So if we get a low rating, they'll take our car away. Thank you. And we're back. This is Arthur Delaney, and I'm joined in studio by my colleague Elise Foley.
Hello.
And Sam Baker, who covers the Supreme Court for Axios. Sam, hello.
Hello.
It's great to have you here because we've had some incredible Supreme Court action with the justices taking up a case over whether the Masterpiece Cake Shop should have baked a cake, a custom cake, for a gay wedding. This cake shop said, no, we won't do it. It's our free speech not to do it. And the offended gay couple sued him, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court over, what, 2 years?
At least, yeah.
So, Sam, first of all, please explain the underlying case a little bit before we get into the Supreme Court oral arguments that happened Tuesday and which you attended.
Sure. I mean, you pretty much got the gist of it there. Same-sex couple walked into a bakery in Lakewood, Colorado, said, we're getting married and we want one of your cakes to be our wedding cake. The owner of the store, his name is Jax Phillips, said, I will not bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. I'll sell you something off the shelf, but I won't go make a custom cake. Colorado has a law on the books that makes it illegal to discriminate against people on the basis of, you know, sort of the usual ones, race, gender, religion, also sexual orientation. They felt they were discriminated against based on their sexual orientation.
Clearly. No? Not clear?
Not clearly enough for it to be resolved anywhere before the Supreme Court, I guess.
So is the case over the facts of what happened with this wedding, or was it a question over whether the state law is constitutional?
It's sort of about the conflict between his religious belief and this non-discrimination law. But then he kind of put another little spin on it, right? Because if you said, for example, I have a store and I sell briefcases and my religion says, you know, women should stay at home and so I won't sell a briefcase to a woman. Sorry, but you can't do that, right? That's just clearly illegal discrimination. So in order to sort of get out of that, he's kind of put this spin on it, the baker, where he says, I'm not just selling something. I'm an artist and I'm doing an artistic expression when I bake a cake.
I love that.
This is my creativity. Like, their briefs go through all this, you know, the cake is his canvas and really play up this angle. So then it becomes not just a freedom of religion issue, but a free speech issue. Because now he's saying, you, the government, and telling me that I have to serve these people are forcing me to make an expression to say something.
So the
issue, right, is that it's kind of could be a slippery slope on both sides because yeah. On one side, you could say, no, this is an expression, and that means that, you know, Jewish bakers have to make a cake with a swastika on it if somebody asks them to. Or on the other hand, you could say that it is, and that means that, you know, everybody can just say, no, I won't do hair for your wedding because you're gay. I don't agree with it.
Yeah,
right? So it's both sides are, you know, this could have a big impact either way they go.
And that was really the crux of the arguments this week. Justice Kennedy, who's the swing vote here, like he is in everything else, was asking a lot of pretty much exactly what you just said, questions on both sides of that coin. He was concerned at one point, you know, if we rule for the baker, can people just put up a sign to save themselves time that says we don't serve gay couples here? And he was thought that would be, as he put it, an affront to the gay community, which...
Duh.
Yeah.
Didn't the attorney say, yeah, they could put up a sign?
Yeah.
No shirt, no shoes, no gays.
Right.
That would be an offensive sign.
Yeah, not great. They'd lose a lot of other business, I think.
Probably.
Yeah,
so.
And why would you do that anyway? Yeah. So what were the other things Kennedy
was
talking
on the
about?
Other side, then John Roberts asked, okay, the Catholic Legal Association, they provide pro bono legal help if you like have a dispute with your landlord or whatever, like sort of, you know, they won't be your lawyer, but little things they can help you with. Obviously, the Catholic Church objects to same-sex marriage, so he wanted to know, well, could a gay couple, if they're having some legal, they need help with their license or some little legal thing, does the Catholic Legal Aid Association have to facilitate this marriage that it doesn't believe in? And, you know, there's sort of—
What do the lawyers say about that question?
I mean, that's a question that every good lawyer at the Supreme Court just tries to get out of. And so, you know, that's not the question before you hear. There was kind of some bad lawyering all around. In this case. Yeah. It was surprising because this is the biggest one of the term.
When you're a court reporter, the reason to focus on Anthony Kennedy is because he's the one who – he's the swing voter who could determine the outcome of the case.
Yes.
And it sounds like he did not betray very clearly which side he was favoring.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, he has been going all the way back, not just the big gay marriage ruling in 2015, but all the way back to when the Supreme Court said, you know, anti-sodomy laws are unconstitutional. It's always been Kennedy and the four liberal justices. Who those justices are have changed, but that's always been the majority. So this is kind of his area. He is the leader on this. He's written all the decisions, not just been in the majority. But he's also really big on free speech. So this is sort of a contradiction for him. And that played out in his questions. He was concerned about both sides. So I think, you know, some people I think are overreacting to this. He was sympathetic to the baker. Like, that's how I would put it. He kind of saw where the guy was coming from. He was concerned. Well, we do have to respect speech and religion. But he is also still the guy that wrote all these other rulings.
Was it Kennedy who pointed out that Colorado had not been nice to the baker?
Yes, it was.
And why does it matter?
He was concerned. I mean, one of Kennedy's just major concerns in the world is people's dignity. That was a big theme in the gay marriage ruling in 2015. And he was sort of concerned that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had not taken the baker's religion seriously. One of the commissioners had made some comments about, like, you know, people have fallen back on religion to excuse all kinds of horrible behavior and discrimination against black people and women and all of this throughout history, which is true, but also some people are good people and just are religious, you know, and I don't think he felt like that kind of got a fair enough shake.
So is there any way to just – that they could just get out of making a broader ruling by just sending it back and saying, hey, you guys didn't do a good job with this, Colorado, and do it again?
Yes.
Okay.
And I wouldn't be at all surprised if that's what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seems easier.
Yeah. Well, yep.
What sort of – what would be a more wide-ranging ruling, like, if they did one, what kind of effects could this case have, so that they don't chicken out and just kick it to a lower court or something like that?
I mean, if they rule widely for the baker, then probably what's going to happen is they're going to have to go through every wedding vendor, which is a lot of people, you know. Okay, is a caterer an artist? That's the only way you could really rule for the baker, right, is to say he's an artist. So, okay, photographer probably would be. Is the caterer? Is the –
You mean state legislatures would have to
or just in the
this?
In the courts.
Or in the courts, yeah. Or some combination of the two. So that's a lot. And if they rule really broadly against the baker, then you'll probably get more into cases where you have – kind of like that hypothetical that Roberts laid out, right? Like where you have some – does a church have to hold a same-sex wedding?
Conservative commentators sometimes refer to this as – bake me a cake, liberalism. And they envision a dystopia where gay people are just forcing bakers to make them cakes all the time. But how often does this happen? Like, how often are couples, like, dissed by florists, photographers, and bakers? It seems like, you know, if one wedding vendor doesn't work out, you can find another. There are lots of them. And is that an issue for the court, like access to these services in places like Colorado?
It is, but it's another one that kind of cuts both ways. One of, I think it was Justice Sotomayor asked about, okay, what about military bases? They're isolated. There's not a lot around. There's probably only one place to get a cake. What if you're in the military? You can serve openly now. You want a cake. That baker refuses to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. What do you do? That's your, you know, you can't just go to another baker. So I don't think we really know exactly how often this happens. I mean, so when it happens,
I would
it flares
say it's
up.
A,
yeah.
It's enough of a concern for people that there are whole, you know, websites and resources for gay couples to figure out what vendors are accepting of gay couples.
So, the lawyers weren't, it doesn't sound like that they were able to provide some sort of definitive documentation of how frequent this is, or, you know, cake deserts or things like that. Like, it seems like we don't, it seems like it's unclear. It's difficult for them because part of the reason is why, because it's unclear how often this is a serious problem for people planning a wedding.
I think Elise is right. Like, it happens enough to take it seriously. And that's good enough for them.
Now, some of the commentary, people were just observing that there were interesting discussions on the finer points of, you know, what is art and what is food.
Yes.
And, like, and Justice Alito said something. What was it that he asked about architecture?
This was just a fascinating thing to watch when I said there was some bad lawyering earlier. So as we talked about, there's this whole debate about is a cake art, right? And so the baker's attorney was up, she was being questioned, and the liberal justices were just trying to pin her down on that question and say, you know, food is for eating. It's not, you don't put a cake in a museum. And sort of going through, you know, well, then is this art? Is that
well,
art?
Well, let's talk about like just wedding cake. Wedding cakes are kind of for eating.
They're right? Kind of for just what?
You do just want to have a nice-looking cake. Like, that is the main point of one, isn't it?
We didn't have a cake at our wedding. And covering this case, I was like, we are still married, right? Like, there's this is the symbolic expression of their love and everything.
Yeah.
We had pie.
Well, what's the artistry of it?
Did you cut the pie, though?
No.
That's you had an interesting wedding.
Pie is better than cake.
Yeah. But what,
obviously, I agree.
What is the artistry of the cake? Is it like the bits of icing on there, like happy wedding in
icing
letters?
I mean, because the issue is that this one was supposed to be custom.
Yeah, they wanted a rainbow cake.
Okay.
Which,
in other words,
like, that's, you know, I could not produce that, right, if you put me in a kitchen.
I would imagine that that's difficult. You're going to different colors of icing, possibly with gradients as the one color changes to another, and then two little male figurines. That's not so hard.
That's probably doable.
But so anyway, they talked about this stuff.
Yes, yes. So the liberals were trying to pin down the baker's lawyer, you know, food is for eating, right? It's not art. And Alito jumped in to try to throw that lawyer a lifeline and said, well, a building is primarily to work in or house people in, but architecture would be protected speech, right? And the lawyer just like threw that life raft right back and said, no, in this context, architecture would not be protected speech. So like,
but she should have said yes.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, this standard now is a cake that you do ultimately eat would be artistic expression, but like, the Empire State Building is just there.
It's
and
just
says
nothing. Yeah, that's weird.
It's the place to go
seems
inside.
Like an easy
yeah,
one.
It's just for people to work. So that was – it was just the wrong answer. Like, there's no other way to put it.
But what was the reaction? Was he – was Alito kind of like
Yeah, Alito was like, okay, I guess we're done with this. And then Breyer, who's a more liberal justice, came back and was like, sort of a weird standard.
Let's make bold predictions.
Okay.
Elise, who's going to win?
I have no idea. I think this one just seems like there are so many people on both sides that are like, you can just look online. There's op-eds from either direction of people being like, I support gay marriage, but, you know, I do think that he shouldn't have to make the cake. And people being like, I'm like, it's just all over the place. My bold prediction is that they'll just kick it back to Colorado and say that they need to be, you know, have dealt with this better.
I agree. I hate to chicken out, but that is actually my prediction about how this will go. I think they'll say these proceedings weren't fair and kick it back and just.
How do they even do it again, though? Because, I mean, this couple is already married now?
Yes. They just kind of the specific facts of these cases fall by the wayside once they get this high up through the system, and it just really becomes about the principle. So they'll kick it back to the Colorado Supreme or the Colorado Commission, and like even if they maybe they'll decide they can't hear it again, and they'll just wait. Another case like this will get to them later, and they'll just deal with it then.
I predict that the Masterpiece Cake Shop will make this couple a cake just to be nice.
I think that ship has sailed. I think you're...
yeah.
I will take that bet. Yeah. Well, it's not called a bold prediction for nothing. Sam Baker, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
For joining the podcast. Elise, thanks as well. We'll be right back. And we're back. This is Arthur Delaney, and I'm joined in studio by my colleague Elise Foley.
Hello.
And my other colleague, Akbar Ahmed.
Hi.
Akbar, you're a foreign policy correspondent, and that's why we need you to help explain what's going on with Donald Trump saying that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. This is a hugely controversial. At the same time, it's something that everyone is familiar with and is always on the verge of being declared. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very – it's a big issue for a couple of like two big reasons. One is that Jerusalem is important to Christianity, Judaism, Islam for many various reasons. In Islam, the prophet is thought to have ascended to heaven from Jerusalem, and that was sort of part of his process of becoming the religious icon he became. The second reason is that Jerusalem, once Israel was established, was divided into East Jerusalem, more Palestinian-controlled, and West Jerusalem. This goes back to 1967 when Israel went into East Jerusalem and now controls it. So even that element of Jerusalem, which was supposed to be part of this shared, you know, this sign of amity and peace between these two peoples, is Israeli controlled. So there's no question. Jerusalem is effectively Israeli. It's not Palestinian. Trump has come out and said, we recognize it as Israeli, which is Palestinians see as giving legitimacy to that claim and to basically saying you can invade whatever you want. And the worry for Palestinians is the two kind of islands of land they still have there, Gaza and the West Bank. In the West Bank, in particular, Israel supports a settlement policy where they encourage Israelis, Jews from all over the world, others to go and kind of start encroaching slowly on Palestinian land. So the Palestinians are like, okay, today you are blessing 50 years ago their invasion of our half of the city. Tomorrow they will slowly take over whatever piece of land we have left, and you'll tell us, well, too bad.
What is
so it's a big symbolic move. It matters for that reason.
In a long run kind of way.
What is the U.S. policy on settlements?
The U.S. Officially does not like settlements.
Right.
The U.S. does not actually do anything to stop settlements, like, you know, limiting military support to Israel or anything else. But, you know, Trump has not reversed that. There was some thought because he appointed a U.S. ambassador to Israel who was very pro-settlements. So there was some suggestions that he would endorse them. He hasn't done that.
So, but the saying Jerusalem is the capital of Israel symbolically is symbolic, but also suggests that there could in the future be more explicit support for the actual encroachment of territory.
And it goes away from what's been the narrative, even if it's sometimes a hollow narrative, which is that eventually there will be two states. And that's officially what the U.S. still supports, even after the Jerusalem move. Let's be real. President Trump has no idea about the implications of any of these things. However, he's setting in motion a chain of events, and a lot of other governments and actors on the ground are going to act on that basis from now on.
He said he would do this during the campaign, didn't he?
Yeah, it's one of those things that a lot of political candidates say, especially Republicans, because evangelical Christians care deeply about this issue because of the Christian implications of Israel. And he did it. You know, because he doesn't care about longstanding U.S. orthodoxy, and he especially doesn't care about the rest of the world. Every other country, the French, the Brits, other people involved in the peace process, American allies, have come out and condemned this. To Trump, not a big deal.
And so is there a – do we move an embassy there is an ancillary question.
This is also like a very strange part of this decision. Trump has decided that the U.S. will – build an embassy in Jerusalem. The U.S. already has a consulate on the embassy in Jerusalem. It could just cross out the sign and say this is now the embassy. But he doesn't want to do that. I guess he likes to build. So,
like
yes.
Building a wall.
Yes. So apparently the U.S. is now going to build an Israeli embassy in Jerusalem.
Now there's been you mentioned a reaction by allies. Yeah. What have they done? Have other countries said that, okay, well, we'll also recognize?
No, other folks are condemning it, particularly the Europeans. The Europeans are really invested in the peace process. And I think we're going to see, this is the kind of thing that I think will backfire, particularly for supporters of Israel and for the Israeli government, because it pushes Israel to become more hardline and maximalist in its demands, which a lot of other countries aren't willing to accept. So it alienates them.
And in general, it's just throwing kind of a new problem into the Middle East, right? Like kicking a hornet's nest.
Absolutely. Like Al-Quds, which is kind of the Palestinian Arab way of describing the Dome of Iraq and Jerusalem. Al-Quds is a narrative, and it's the term used for everything from Iran's like paramilitary force across the region to a lot of groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. So this definitely helps folks with recruitment because, yeah, it's always been thought that America is whatever, the great Satan, it'll betray Arabs and Muslims. This is great evidence of that if you're a recruiter for one of those groups, and that's the worry.
So speaking of backlash, everyone said there will be backlash, and then, you know, sure enough, within a few hours, there were TV images of people being mad. But how serious is the backlash, really? I mean, the protests are not necessarily a huge deal.
Not that serious, and that's part of why the Palestinians are so worried, because in the long run, even their supporters in the Arab and Muslim world, you know, even the Saudis, for example, you know, technically the leaders of the Muslim world, they control the holiest sites in Islam. The Saudis oppose the policy publicly, but we've seen extensive reporting that privately Saudi Arabia said, you know what, go ahead, we don't really care. Saudis don't care. Egyptians, everyone has their own problem. And traditional powerful Arab countries like Syria and Iraq aren't as powerful anymore. So
what I mean, so the Trump has said it's been our foreign policy to almost do this for a long time, right?
So I mean, Congress voted to do it.
In June, yes.
Yeah. And what, in 1995 for the first time?
Yeah, and they just keep doing
just
it. Democrats.
Pushed it back.
Yeah.
Every six months, the president signs a waiver and says, no, we're not going to do that.
Democrats are in favor of it.
Yeah.
And so Trump said this situation, you know, this sort of conflict there has been constant during that time.
Yes.
Yeah. Why not just do something differently so that something different happens?
Yeah.
What about that logic? That's kind of, it doesn't seem like the cleverest thing, but what about it? What do you think of that?
I think the best way to look at that logic is to think about an analogy, okay? So, like, it's kind of like the Iran nuclear deal. The Iran nuclear deal is a deal between five world powers and Iran. And Republicans are trying to torpedo it. That is one half of one branch of one government. Now, okay, it's the whole of the U.S., kind of two branches of government. You can't. That's not how multilateral, you know, peace processes and all this work. So while Congress might support it, the American Congress is one player in this whole huge process, and other players are going to do what they're going to do. So, for instance, if there's a significant radicalizing of the Palestinian side, a deal becomes much harder to reach. So you might say, yeah, traditionally, this wouldn't make a difference. But now that you've done it, what other moves are people going to do so that your calculus has to change entirely? And Israel doesn't maybe end up with the most beneficial end.
But what about the Trump's apparent concept of disrupt?
Yeah.
Like, how is that possibly helpful? On a superficial level, it seems like it's obviously not helpful to do something disruptive where stability is one of the top concerns. Right. So is it possible that it's disruptive in a helpful way or not?
It depends on how you define helpful, but I don't think it's disruptive in a way that will reduce conflict. No. So I don't think it's disruptive in a – you know, Palestinians' issues were not around just Jerusalem. And so Palestinians are going to continue to be angry, and I think they're going to get angrier. And so, no, I think that it'll become even more intractable.
Why are evangelical Christians so obsessed with this? Okay, go ahead.
It's very theological, kind of belief in Jerusalem's control and then the apocalypse, depending on who you talk to. So, you know, you'll have noticed in the television announcement that Trump gave, Pence was standing right behind him.
Yes.
Right? So sort of hand of God, you know, hand of God's chosen vice president and maybe president to be. This is important. This is important to them, and they've pushed for it for a long time. But it's another example of how evangelical Christians, right, are not necessarily thinking about Christians in the region. Middle East Christians, Christian leaders in Jerusalem came out against this move, and it makes their lives a lot harder.
Right. I read that there was a dimming of lights on Christmas trees as part of a protest.
Right.
Well, it's an easy kind of symbolic thing to care a lot about if you're very far away and the implications, that's not going to really affect you in much of any way in the immediate future, right? If you're just an evangelical here, but if you're a Christian there, it's different the way you think about these things.
It's very scary. And a lot of Christians there, I mean, do think that the U.S. is not even-handed, right, in the way it says it will be between Israel and Palestinians.
How much is the apocalypse piece really – how important is that really in the evangelical Christian view? I mean, the country is an ally. Israel is – you know, a democracy.
Yeah.
So you can see for secular reasons why some people would want to be, you know, more gung-ho about Israel. But what the apocalypse thing is strange. I've read this a lot over the years, but haven't studied it. And it has often seemed like too ridiculous to believe that people think the end of the world will be tangled up in this country. So we should redirect our foreign policy for that, you know, ultimate outcome.
I think the fact that it is too ridiculous to believe is one reason why it's not an explicitly stated thing, right? So you'll see a lot of explicit stuff from evangelical leaders, members of Congress who'll say Israel, a long time and important ally, you know, but they're not going to explicitly say here's why we think it. So it's important to be honest,
I'd never heard that before.
Yeah.
I will betray my ignorance.
It's a thing.
Yeah. But it's context, you know, it's the mood music more than it is the...
Okay, so it's not something that's explicitly said. You know, maybe I'm referring to an uncharitable interpretation of what the evangelical motive is.
It's a widely held view,
yeah.
But it's a view that's seen as quite radical, as you're saying. And so it's a view that no one wants to say we want to hurtle towards the apocalypse, right? So
We joke about it all the time.
Yeah, look at Twitter. And people are always saying we want the apocalypse.
Okay. And what's striking about it is that the Israelis... don't care, especially right-wing Israelis.
Right.
Like, whatever your motivations are, the Israelis have embraced anti-Semites in Eastern Europe, and it shows you a lot about the craven nature of the current Israeli government as well.
All right, well, hopefully the world won't end.
Jared Kushner's on it.
I know this is a classic Jared's on the case situation. Where he thought, you know, the backlash will blow over in a few days,
right,
or so. Yeah.
Do we know, was he one of the people pushing for this? He was supportive,
He's supportive, and I think people forget that Netanyahu, the current prime minister of Israel, has been a figure in Jared Kushner's life for 20 years, since he was a teenager, you know? And so any image of the U.S. being even-handed in this process is totally shattered at this point.
Akbar Ahmed, thank you so much for helping us understand this.
Sure, thank you for having me.
All right, Elise Foley, bye.
Bye.
So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Zach Young. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Arthur Delaney. And this week we were joined by HuffPost reporters Elise Foley, Marina Fang, and Akbar Ahmed, as well as Sam Baker, healthcare and court reporter for Axios. So That Happened is available on Apple Podcasts. Check out the whole family of HuffPost podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, please give us a 5-star rating, or 4 stars, but no fewer than 4 stars. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, seriously, email me at sothathappened@huffpost.com. I'll personally respond. Thanks to all of you for listening. And also thanks to Packers Fangirl for the comment she put on our iTunes page.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.